floodgates. It's time to welcome the river. The river of life.
You are listening to the Go Health Podcast. The Go Health Podcast seeks to explore stories, how people have found healing, and how we can learn from them, from their stories of human flourishing, some ordinary, some extraordinary. I'm Gillian Strain, and I run the Guild of Health and St. Raphael.
So today, on the Go Health Podcast, we are delighted to welcome Professor Jim McManus. Jim, you are, amongst other things, the Director of Public Health for Hertfordshire County Council. You're also a chartered psychologist and a chartered scientist. You're also on the board of the Association of Directors of Public Health. You're also a visiting professor at the University of Hertfordshire. So that's your short CV. Plus, you're the president of the Guild of Health in St. Raphael. You're a busy man.
Yeah, I don't get any much.
Blessings flow. Blessings flow through our lives.
So thank you for giving us this time in March 2021 as we approach the anniversary of the first lockdown. It's really a privilege to chat to you about your life, about your work, and what you've been through in the last year with the pandemic. Can you tell us a little bit about, so I've given the kind of the CV version of who you are. How did you get to be what you're doing today, and what drives you?
I've always been interested in health, and I've always been interested in theology. So I actually applied for medicine at university. And on the first night of the interview, I got food poisoning. And on the second day, my glasses fell on the floor of a tiled floor in the university and smashed. And I thought, this isn't for me. And I decided to change to theology instead, but kept doing volunteer work. And then when I went into, my first job, you couldn't be a public health consultant or director unless you were a medic. And eventually, so I worked in all sorts of areas in public health that didn't require a medical degree. And then when they opened it up, I took the plunge, went through the programme to get on the register, and basically applied for jobs and worked my way up from public health specialist to director of public health in previously Birmingham and now here. So that's how I got into public health. And it seemed to me to be something that both used my values and used my faith, because as a Catholic there is a very strong kind of vocational element to working in healthcare, and there's a very strong social justice element to public health, and it seemed to me that this was the kind of place where God wanted me to be, if you like, because it blended the values that the church had taught me with a kind of a commitment for health of the population and a commitment for Catholic social teaching. So it kind of felt obvious, although it took me a while to realise that was what was happening.
It's always easier to look backwards, isn't it, to work out where God's been leading us rather than look forwards. Oh, I find that.
I think you're right, and I'm a bit thick on the uptake as far as God's concerned. So there are times when you look back and you think, oh, that's what you were up to, but you don't realise it at the time.
And as a person of faith, how explicit is your practice of your faith in your work? And has being a Catholic got easier in a very public role in health promotion?
I would say that there was a period of about 10 years where it was very difficult to be a person of faith in the public sector. And I remember in 2012, I did some work with a senior civil servant. We did a survey of every NHS trust on diversity, and religion was the area they found most problematic and challenging. And I think the mistake we took was to treat faith as if it's something private rather than something personal, and somehow you leave your faith at the door but you bring every other protected characteristic in. I think by dint of sheer determination, I think a lot of us have ground that down. Because for me, the reason I do my job is because of my faith. It is an expression of my faith. You look particularly at the church's social teaching, and just going back to John 10:10, you know, where Jesus says, "I've come that everyone might have life and have it in its fullness." That's a complete manifesto for public health, I think. My doing my job is a living out of my faith commitment, and I don't think I could do my job if I didn't have my faith.
And from the other side, science is beginning to recognise, or health science, that our spirit, the spiritual side of our beings, is important for our physical and mental health. So I wonder if, from other angles, a person of faith working in health is sort of ratified by what we're discovering in science and psychology.
I think you're absolutely right, and it's quite interesting that the spirituality and health agenda, and I'm not keen on the S word, because I think the spirituality word is often used very sloppily by people, but there is a huge amount of research in organisational psychology about the role of faith and spirituality in the workplace. And ironically, the private sector have done far more on this than a lot of the public sector, where faith was a dirty word for too long. But if you look at epidemiology, I mean, there are pioneers like Harold Koenig, who started this work some years ago. There's now a massive evidence base that faith can be both a protective factor in your health, it can help you be healthy and cope, it can also be a vulnerability factor in kind of making you more vulnerable if your faith is maladjusted or too full of shame. But there's several journals now devoted to religion and health, scientific journals. There's a body of public health scholarship on the relationship between health and faith. And it feels like what Christians have known for years, science has rediscovered.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you've done some health work with the Vatican in the past. Is that right?
I've done several bits. So during the Ebola, last Ebola crisis a few years ago, I was somehow roped in to help with guidelines on safe burial, and also did a lot of work on hospital and healthcare chaplaincy with what used to be the Pontifical Commission for Health Pastoral Care, and also did some seminars for them on the relationship between science and health and various other things. And I have worked for, I mean, I think I have been advising the Catholic bishops in England and Wales since 2003 on healthcare stuff, which, gosh, that's a long time, isn't it? I've been lucky enough to be able to serve in a voluntary basis the church, both at national and international level, and that's been some wonderful opportunities there.
I mean, the church has always been interested in health, since Jesus said, "In you know, go and make disciples and heal in my name." There's always been a healing ministry. But do you think that the church's focus on health has changed over the years, or are we just becoming more aware of it?
I think there is a change, because an awful lot of the focus was on health care. I mean, so as a Catholic, you're growing up, you've got loads of saints who were doctors or nurses or cared for the sick. You've got loads of examples that are religious orders. The Camillians is an order I've always been very attracted to. I'm a trustee of a hospice run by an order of nuns that is all about hospitals and healthcare, and they run several hospices. But what I think we lost was the insight that has been there, and a lot of people say, well, let's go back to the early church, but actually this insight has been around through all of Christianity, that health is about wholeness and balance and the whole person. And you said in a lecture you gave that actually the church needs to rediscover that healing and mission need to go hand in hand. It's not about bums on pews, it's actually about healing the world. I discern in the work that Guild's doing another intervention by the Holy Spirit, I think, to take us through rediscovering this Christian insight that health is about balance between person, God, neighbour and environment. And that's where health sits. And if you look at the history of the church, every time the church has become a bit too focused on one thing, a movement has sprung up to balance that. I mean, you know, the origins of Methodism, for example. So I think the church is called to rediscover that, but we need to do a lot more on that. In a way, people often say that Catholic social teaching is the Catholic Church's best kept secret. Actually, healing and balance is the church's best kept secret, and we need to share that.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, what about church isn't about healing from, you know, the mass or laying on of hands, but also the welcome at the door? That's make or break point for some people. Whether you go into the community at all, your mom's in talks group, you're dealing with a lot of maternal mental health issues, you know, and making an enormous difference. There's almost nothing that, for me, I get, maybe I'm a bit, I've got my kind of blinkers on a bit, but the, you know, it's all about healing as far as I'm concerned. The whole of the spiritual life is a movement towards ultimate healing with God.
I think you're right. And if you look at the history of spirituality, I mean, particularly like the Spanish mystics, so Teresa of Avila is you know, a great influence on me. And she travelled all over Spain, despite having really serious physical health issues. But actually, you could say that she was one of the most healthy women of her time because she had a clear vision. She was always looking over the back of her shoulder at whether the Inquisition were coming for her. Because she was, you know, she was a bright, gifted woman leader in a time of the Inquisition and very open to the mystical side of spirituality. And I think what that teaches us is, for me, there's several things. First of all, everything about our Christian life and church's life should be about healing. And actually, the welcome you give people at the door really matters. But also, at the same time, you know, the healing ministry doesn't start in wafting oil about and having healing services. It actually starts in how you organise the community in a way to support people be whole people. Now, for Catholics, that the Eucharist is the beginning and the centre of that. But actually, for most churches, the communal church life should be the place where we can discern, is this a healing community or not? And I completely agree with you.
I mean, talking about St. Teresa there, I was reminded of another Spanish mystic I've been thinking about in January, is St. John of the Cross, whose particular focus was on the dark night of the soul. And I mean, in this time of pandemic and suffering and people being shut in, that when we are closed down and going through difficult periods, it's tough, but also an opportunity. And I know from your background that, you know, health and healing is not just a professional interest, it's personal to you as well. And you've had a time in your life when you faced serious illness. And I wonder if you might share some of that story with us and how it impacted on your faith.
Gladly. I mean, so I remember in 2012, I started getting quite a large lump under my left arm and wondering what it was. I went to the doctor and the doctor says, just assessed, have some fluid oxycillin. And it grew and grew and grew and then started growing over my shoulder. I was in huge pain, couldn't sleep. Went for a scan and got the results and got told by the doctor, you've got a cancer which has spread, you've got a tumour that's 23 centimetres in your abdomen and a big one that has started under your arm and gone. And it was basically non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Now, blood cancers and cancers in general are quite common in my family. My sister had a form of leukaemia. And they said, and you know, you don't take things in. You think, well, that's it, I'm going to die. You need to go to hospital. So I went into hospital on the 4th of December 2012. And I came out at the end of March 2013. So it was a, it started at Advent and ended at the end of Lent. It was a very long Lent. And I don't think I was expected to survive because it was a grade four by the time they got it. And it was, but I was lucky because it was a very fast growing cancer, which meant it really responded to the chemotherapy. But the chemotherapy was a, well, that was fun. You know, so it left me with I got some inflammation, some encephalitis from the ifosfamide, and it gave me nerve damage and a bit of sight and a bit of hearing loss, half a dead foot and a whole load of other stuff, and short-term memory problems. So, and I still have, my jaw's still out of alignment because I had tumours in the jaw. But I still remember being very, very frightened in a ward in UCLH, where the windows were, you had to stand up to see out the windows. I think it was ward 16 I was on. And you ended up, it was very frightening, but I got this sudden feeling one day that everything would be all right. I had the sacrament of healing, what Catholics used to call last rites, but it wasn't last rites, twice during my stay with some friends around. And that was a really intense moment. I had a lot of pain. I don't tolerate opiates, so I couldn't take morphine. So my painkillers for my whole cancer journey were some tramadol and paracetamol. And I think the doctors thought I was crazy, but and it was quite scary. I got several infections. I got pneumonia once and all sorts of other stuff. But I just had this sense of peace throughout all of it. And I remember the nurse saying one day, she said, you know, the doctors think you're unstoppable. And I said, well, that's not me. That's, you know, I think I have a feeling I have something here still to achieve. And a lot of good came out of it, actually. And some of the good that came out of it was, I know what it's like to be so vulnerable, I can't walk five steps. And I know what it's like to be very, very ill. But I also know what it's like to experience healing. Now, 15 years ago, I'd have been dead because the cancer treatment hadn't evolved. So it is something that has stayed with me ever since. And I've had one or two scares since where, you know, they said, oh, we found lumps, and then gone, oh, no, it's not lumps. It's actually just an infection. And you're never fully right. But I think it's taught me a whole load of stuff. Including that actually all will be well. It's an experience that somebody once said to me, why do you see lots of good come out of your cancer? I said, because lots of good did come out of it. I'm not saying I'd go, yay, let's do it all again. But I do think if I had to turn back the clock and it was put in front of me, knowing what I know now, I wouldn't say no. But the benefit of hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And we've been through a period as a globe, a nation, as communities, as churches, as workplaces, and as individuals of a terrible time of suffering with a pandemic. The word unprecedented has just become boring. An unprecedented use of the word unprecedented. But goodness, how do you describe what we're going through? With my kids, I tell them, you know, this is a bit like World War II, just to try to, and I find that helpful as well, you know, to try to get my head around the scale of what we've been through over the last year. With the pandemic, how have you stayed healthy during this pandemic with your workload and your health background?
It has been crazy. I mean, it's been kind of 12 and 13 hour days at times, and 14 hour days at times, and sometimes 7 days a week. And the gyms are closed, so I can't do weightlifting. So I have to do walking or cycling or in-house workouts. But I guess the things that got me through these times are, one is, this will pass, science will find a way out of this if we pull together, but we need hearts and minds. I think the second thing personally is actually making time for prayer every day. And one of the things I've found is, so I try either to read the Daily Office, and if I'm just too exhausted, I at least make sure I do the rosary and the scripture rosary. And I found, and I think I've been praying the rosary every day since this started. I think the third thing is the Bible Reading Fellowship, daylight notes, you know, a chapter in a row. So setting aside half an hour every day for prayer at least has really worked for me. Setting aside time just to have downtime has really worked for me. Also, keeping your head, because on a daily basis, I get emails from people screaming at me that we're killing them because of lockdown. But I also get emails from people saying this lockdown isn't tight enough and you can't please everybody. So I try to stick rigidly to the science and say, look, there is no perfect solution to this. There is no way out of this. It is going to be traumatic. And drawing on my previous experience of dealing with traumatic experiences like cancer helps. But also, this isn't the first pandemic I've been in. It's by far the worst. I do think, I'm not quite sure what I'd do if I didn't have my faith. It really has kept me going and has given me resilience. And I know lots of people are praying for me and lots of people are being supportive. But that's the kind of attempt to find balance in the midst of this, to try and find some peace.
We've been praying for you every week in noonday prayer and alongside other healing agencies and all our members, as well as those people in need. And I love the way you describe that, because and I asked that question in a deliberate way. How have you stayed healthy without defining what health is? And there you talked about your physical health, you talked about your spiritual health, and you talked about your emotional health. And all three are so important, because if one falls away, then you're going to struggle with the other two, aren't you?
Yeah, you really are. And they all have to be the same. And it's quite odd doing several national rules and a local rule in the midst of this pandemic. Because the benefit of it is you get to see things other people are doing that you can learn from. The downside is you have to put in silly hours, but also you see lots and lots of people in pain. So pastoral care for other people in networks, you know, other directors of public health who have struggled with issues, but also directors of public health and other people who struggled with me when I've had difficult times, and the support of the Guild, I think, has been tangible. But it is holding on to that physical, spiritual, psychological balance that has kept me going.
And you mentioned there when you have, I mean, it sounds like people are pulling on your time every day, and questions that are difficult to answer, and people's, you know, acting out of a traumatic position. We're all being traumatized by this. But you said you go back to the science. It seems to me the science has taken a bit of a hit during this pandemic. Everyone's an expert all of a sudden. And science is a tricky thing, because science is actually about interpretation of observations of the world, and that might change. So there's an understanding of what science is has been attacked. And also we're in uncharted territory. And there's something to do with how we communicate, and that's part of your role is communication of that. What, looking back, how could things have been done better around the communication of the understanding of the pandemic?
I think you've hit the nail on the head with science taking a hit, because I think what we've had is scientism, not science. This idea that science is infallible. And I do a series of webinars for people in Hertfordshire, and routinely we get about 250 elected members on them. And I said recently, the trouble with science is it's not an exact science. It's anything but an exact science. Science is faulting and fallible, and as you say, it's about interpretation. So I think we could have an opportunity here to get rid of scientism and scientific dogmatism. But I think the mistakes that have been made, first of all, we needed better national communications to keep hearts and minds, because all the social psychology says you don't You don't get out of a pandemic by shaming people. You get out of a pandemic by keeping them on board and building a spirit of solidarity and togetherness. And I think we need to learn that as a country. Secondly, I do wish some of the scientists would just stop arguing with one another in public, because you get a statement and then what you get, and if you're trained in scientists, you understand that there's a debate going on. But it sounds like to members of the public, scientists are all just disagreeing and having an argy-bargy. And there is a moral responsibility, I think, if you're going to speak into the public square, of at least try to get your facts right and understand the impact this will have on people who actually aren't as buried in the detail as you are. So being a scientist, I think, or being some of the kind of media loved scientists at the minute, people seem to think means saying what you like. It doesn't. You have to really think that through. So I think there needs to be better responsibility from government, better responsibility from the scientific community. I think that, ironically, the corollary of that is there needs to be much greater transparency of both certainty and uncertainty, and an acknowledgement that lockdowns are a really bad tool apart from every other tool, which is also a really bad tool, because everything you do in this pandemic hurts some folk while helping others. And that's a difficult, painful place to be. But how many of our scientists and policymakers are actually acknowledging that difficult? I mean, I don't want to be in this lockdown. I think the only reason we're in this lockdown is because we took the wrong policy choices nationally in 2020, and we simmered in and out of rises in the virus, and then it just boiled over. I think we need humility and real kind of discernment. And I think Christian scientists and scientists of faith can bring that to the table.
And let's look at the faith side of it. The church had to respond as well to the situation they found themselves in. There was a virus that was not understood well, and it ended up shutting its doors during the first lockdown. Looking back on the same year, how could the church have done it better? And what made it difficult for them to respond well in the crisis that everyone faced?
I think one of the problems was that you were getting huge numbers of people who decided they knew better, and they were coming from an ideological position of the church must stay open at all costs. And I know we've all had personal criticism for that, but I think we had no alternative other than to shut during lockdown. But I think there were several things we could and should have done better. The first is actually sit down and think, well, what does that mean? So while there was a great move to online stuff, why did we stop? Why did some denominations stop clergy going into their own churches, which was completely unnecessary, really? There was also a really nasty undercurrent of, and I remember seeing this on social media, well, our clergy should be prepared to die for us because that's what they did in the year of typhoid. And you think, what kind of theology is underpinning that? And the good thing is the church moved to support and care for people. And you know, that was, people would have died without that. I think we should have inserted more theology into what is God calling the church to do. And P.S. it's not privatized religion. This is Christianity is a communal religion. It's not about your rights and your right to your church. It's about church as the people of God, and not a building, but what role does the building have in the mission of the church during a pandemic? And I think we should have been much more upfront about that. The situation we're in now is that the national policy said churches can open, but local decisions can allow them to close. And I think that allows room for discernment. But what we have to do is the idea that somehow churches closing is an attack on the faith, I just don't get, because some people are saying, actually, I miss the sacraments and I need the sacraments. Other people are saying online worship has really done something for me, and other people are saying the social mission of the church has never been as good. So how do you look across that and take the good from that? We can reach more people than we've reached in a while. there has been a benefit from our mission, but there's a lot of people hurting and healing. So I think we need to sit down and discern what is coming out of the pandemic and what that means for the church for the next 10 years. And I think the Guild is more needed than ever before. Because if you get people who will never darken the door of a church because of the way the building happens, but will go to online worship, that's a plus, isn't it?
It's interesting, isn't it? We talked earlier about there's in general, people misunderstand science and think it's just, you know, it's just a fact generator. But actually, science is a process of interpretation, and the best we've got right now is kind of science. It's the same with theology. Is not a big thing that's in a box somewhere that we just open up and have a look at to get all the answers. Instead, theology has always developed over time. It's always been an interpretation of the scriptures, an interpretation of what's gone in the past, the tradition. But it's always been an interpretation also of what we're going through right now. And what big world events, even quite small world events, can change theology. For example, after the Second World War, there was a huge shift in theology. And our understanding of where one might find God in the world, given the suffering that we went through in the Second World War. What is your first attempt of what a post-COVID theology for the church might look like? How has COVID changed the church and our theological understanding, or missiological understanding?
So for some strange reason, I decided it was a good idea to start doing my doctorate in theology, and I'm doing it at Roehampton. And I have had a month and a half of block. I'm trying to do my doctoral thesis on the relationships between Catholic social teaching, public health and faith. And this very question you've got has just caused me to have a block. And I there's a whole pile of theology. There's about 20 different books. I think currently, and this will probably change, that COVID is an impetus for us to rediscover the basic nature of mission, which is about human wholeness. That has to be about the common good and about the kind of biblical view, if you like, of caring for the most vulnerable, including everybody, as well as giving everybody hope. Whether you choose that from Catholic social teaching or the scriptures, it doesn't really matter. I think there is an invitation for us to go back to the Gospels and relook at the Gospels and see the ministry of Jesus and the person of Jesus as making people whole and making wholeness and healing both at an individual level and at a societal level the front and centre in our mission. Partly because we will come out of this with huge inequalities. The virus has brought a wave of virus, but it's also brought a wave of mental ill health, financial challenges, inequality, racism, you know, every difficulty and evil under the sun you could find has been let loose by it. But it has also let loose light and glory and grace. And how do we use this as a kind of kairos moment, an opportunity to renew the church, to kind of bring people hope in a real tangible way? And that, I think, means something about how we model basic Christian communities around caring for and loving and helping people. It also means, I think, we need to revisit what we mean by sanctification. The idea that as Christians you can't be divorced from the church. So, and how do we reach out to everybody that we as a church have alienated? And coming at the end of the kind of scandals around child abuse and various other things and abuse of power, I wonder if it's an invitation for us, for a more humbled church, to kind of go back in and bring people back out of the kind of mindset of individualism and not worrying about others into a much more we're in this together.
These gems are falling. I'm so glad we're recording this. I want to come back to the missiological stuff that you think might emerge after COVID, but just stay almost with, you know, sort of hardcore theology for a bit, because one thing I think I discern people are struggling with this pandemic is that is the level of death. And I've been struck every evening where we're almost like we're tuning in the wireless, or I feel that's what I do. I try to put the TV news on, tuning in the wireless to find out the death count. I mean, how horrifying that is. And when I'm leading prayers, often I say, you know, that it's, we've got statistics, but each of those are individuals surrounded by communities of friends and family. Each one of those is a desperate tragedy. Each one of those is surrounded by healthcare professionals, presumably who are being traumatized by what we're going through. And I wonder if COVID has also drawn our attention to our lack of ability to cope with death. Because the Christian healing ministry is never just about getting better. And it's one of the things that elevates it above, you know, new age approaches to health or just spirituality, is because we actually deal with the elephant in everyone's room right now, which is death. And I wonder if this pandemic will help us look more seriously at death as part of life. And with that, a sort of theodical approach. How do we cope with bad stuff happening in the world? You know, as a Christian, how would you tackle these questions today with this overwhelming death count we're getting on a daily basis? Here's a classic question. How can a God that has wrought us in our mother's womb, who loves us, let this virus loose? And how do we cope with that at a spiritual and emotional level?
I think it brings out several things. The first thing is that it goes back to that line for me in St. Paul, because when I sit and dwell on the kind of issues of evil, I am brought back to the fact that most evils we talk about are from the natural world. And you know, that line of St. Teresa that we are God's hands. So Christ has no hands on earth but ours. So our duty is to kind of get stuck in and try and make things better and remedy it. I believe with all my heart what St. Paul says, that nothing can cut us off from the love of God. So I reject the idea that COVID is from God as a chastisement. And I think it is just something that you would expect to occur with the laws of nature. We're getting more and more of these diseases emerging from the animal world, zoonotic infections, as we encroach more and more on animal habitats. And I think what it says to us is something about the arrogance of humanity. You know, the biblical view is that we're meant to be stewards of the earth, not overlords and masters of it, using it and exploiting it as a commodity. So if anything, COVID should make us check ourselves about the consequences of our own global actions is the first thing. I think the second issue that it brings to me is I find the discourse around death staggering, because people saying, well, there's only X deaths, or there's only X deaths. Why are so few people dying? Why are our hospitals not full? And it's like, well, actually, if you walked into a hospital ward in most areas of England right now, you'd find that a lot of the hospitals were full to overflowing. And since when did we decide that there was an acceptable number of deaths from a pandemic, where there's only several hundred people die? Well, that's somebody's mother or father or son or daughter, and they're precious. And I think it says two things. One is there's the utter failure of a society that doesn't have a sense of mortality at its heart to cope with death. We shun it and we get scared of it and we put it away. And I think a calling back to the kind of idea that we are finite and we do have to address death. And I think the second thing it teaches us is the need to understand that vulnerability is a part of everybody's life before death. But death will bring the ultimate vulnerability, but, you know, vulnerability to illness. And we seem to want to have a society where every illness can be cured and we can do what we like. And again, that to me called me back to the idea of the common good and the fact that we are not individual atoms in this wee postmodern bubble, that we can do what we like. Actually, we owe one another a duty from our common humanity. I think there's an opportunity theologically to address that. Neither the laser beam God who comes in and does, you know, I'll invoke God and God will make this go away. No, the God who's punishing for us from COVID, I think, represent the God of the scriptures who's inviting us to, in the midst of this trauma, rediscover what it means to be human. And authentic humanity means balanced relationship with God, with ourselves, with our neighbours and with our earth. And we've lost that. Most of us are not in balanced relationship, or are any of us, certainly not with the earth we live on.
And COVID's just sort of, in some ways it hasn't given any new problems, it's just exposed the problems that were there already. And it's brought them to the fore. And in that way, there's opportunities to move. And certainly in the Guild of Health, when I seem to always be working on definite, how do you define this? How do you define that? How do you define healing? And for me and for the work in the Guild, everything we're trying to do is to help people flourish, to find balance with self, balance with community, balance with the environment, and balance with God. Because that is scriptural. And that seems to promote our health within ourselves, if we're mind, body and spirit. So there's an opportunity, I think, of COVID. And going back to you highlighted, I think, the missiological opportunities for the church in COVID. And by that, I mean how the church might be the body of Christ in the world. There's sort of opportunities to change because of what we've been through in COVID. And I think you put that so succinctly and beautifully. And also it's a kind of exciting. We've got this opportunity. It's really exciting. That we don't have to just bang on about, you know, telling folk about Jesus and expect them to come to church and, you know, and put some money in the pot on your way in. That's not what we're about. We're actually about creating churches which are hubs for healing, that people can come and find ways to feel better, become more connected with themselves and with the community and with God, and to flourish. That's what we're about. And I was struck a few months ago a report was released by an all-party parliamentary group called Keeping the Faith. And it was a fantastic read. It was the government, correct me if I'm wrong, the government had sort of gone and done some research and asked a bunch of councils all over England, you know, how have you found working with church communities during the pandemic? And, you know, 80% of them came back and said, they've been amazing. We had no, I'm paraphrasing, this is not what the fancy report said. But basically, this report said, they're amazing. They've got heaps of connections. We didn't know about that. They could act really quickly. When we said we needed food banks and mental health supports, they acted really quickly. We didn't know they could do that. Hey, everyone, churches are great. And other faith bodies, it wasn't just churches, it was other faith-based organizations. But it's a wonderful report because it's sort of what we know about the church, but the secret's kind of getting out. And I wondered what degree we now have that opportunity. We're doing the work of God, but actually the secular bodies are like, we need to engage with the church in order to improve public health. How would you advise church communities to go about this, keeping in balance? We're not just another third party to be used. We're doing this as part of our mission. How do we do it well?
So I think, first of all, start from the inexhaustible riches of grace and prayer and theology. That's where all this has to come from. And I think the mistakes we often make is, we don't want social workers with a cross around their neck. We want Christians in it. And you said missiological opportunities. There's two massive opportunities arise from this. The first is for us to do what the Second Vatican Council called being a leaven in the world. So there's an opportunity for us to educate civil society about how the church can be a leaven in the world from its capabilities and its attitudes and its people. That has to stem from prayer and from being responsive to Christ's call to help all people flourish. I think the second big opportunity is to get rid of this idea of healing as the World Health Organization called it, a complete state of mental, physical, social and spiritual well-being. Well, I don't know about you, but I've never been there. Actually, health is actually much more about finding balance in the midst of a messy life and teaching people that skill. So if you take those two skills, those two big missiological opportunities, how do faith communities go about it? Well, I think the first thing is actually audit your skills. What skills do you have? What capabilities do you have that you can actually deliver and reliably deliver. So there's no point promising to go in and, you know, give your building over to be a night shelter for the homeless if you're not prepared to understand what that means, for example. And then I think the second thing is build relationships with some sympathetic local councillors and build relationships with your director of public health or the person who leads the equalities work in your council, and actually start to have a robust conversation and bring everybody else to the table. And I think we have to break engagement with faith out of the equalities box. Actually, faith communities need to be sitting down and talking to the director of adult care and the director of children's service about what it means to be a healthy child and what can faith communities do there. And then you have to break this nonsense about that means we're proselytising. Caring for people's flourishing does not mean you have to shove a Bible down their throat. There are so many more things you can do. So I think it's that. There is a, I think it was in 2002 when I was working for NACRU, I did a guide on how faith communities and crime and disorder partnerships could work together. And in 2008, I did a guide for the then Office of the Deputy Prime Minister, I think it was then, about how resilience partnerships and faith communities could work together. So the principles are there about organisational engagement. I think just go and get stuck in and have an honest conversation.
Thank you so much, Jim. We're drawing to the end, but I just have one final question. This is us, March 2021. It's the anniversary of the first lockdown, the first national lockdown on coronavirus. Looking backwards, looking across your professional and your personal expertise in this area, what advice can you give everyone who's listening to this today about how to have hope as we look into year two of this situation and beyond?
Yeah, so it's been a year, hasn't it, which is quite a shock when you look back. I think my advice would be hold on to the fact that science is bringing us solutions to get out of this. The downside of that is actually we need policymakers to listen to them and do a very careful opening up. So be vocal that actually the more slowly and the more carefully we open up, the more we'll control the virus and enable the vaccine to do its job. So there is hope. I think the second piece of hope is the fact that we have learned a lot during this pandemic about how to recover and keep ourselves sane. This will be a marathon, not a sprint. We're not going to heal all the mental ill health and trauma in a week. It will take a decade to get out of this. But we know that. I think the third hope is that the virus has mutated to the point where the new variants haven't yet escaped the vaccine. Some of the old measures still work. That is also hopeful. I think the fourth sign of hope I would take from this is that there are countries in the world that have curbed and controlled the virus and have reopened carefully and safely. And if we follow their example, we can do that. And I think the fifth sign of hope is that the church has come through this. We haven't shut thousands of churches. We've actually found relevance, and that relevance will continue. And actually, the sixth sign of hope is every little helps. What every single individual does make a difference. If I treat myself as infected, I stop others from infecting me and getting infected, and I reduce the burden on the NHS. If I help somebody with an act of kindness, that's one person who might eat tonight who might otherwise not. And you may never see that in the media, but it is a sign of hope. And we have to take that as such.
Professor Jim McManus, thank you so much for everything you do. It gives me hope that you are up there at such a high level in public health as a man of faith, with such wisdom helping to guide us through and guide the other experts through what we're all going through. Thank you for giving us your time to the Go Health podcast, and God bless you in everything that you do.
Thank you, and you too, and the Guild.
You have been listening to the Go Health podcast. Our theme music is from the song River of Life by Lofter. To continue the conversation and to find out more about the Go Health community. Go to our website, gohealth.org.uk, and find us also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And there, join in the conversation, because together we flourish.